You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 10th of June 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. Coming up on today's programme, from Israel and Libya to Nigeria and Washington, we'll review today's top news stories with Daniela Peled and James Schneider. Then we're in Argentina to delve into a corruption case, a national park, and of course, the World Cup.
Everyone is talking about football. Football is everywhere. On television, on the front pages of newspapers, it's impossible to miss it.
And we look at a new photography book chronicling the playfulness and vulnerability of young soldiers in the Second World War.
When I found that there was a song called My Buddy, right away I knew all and read the lyrics, and I thought, my God, these lyrics are so loving. And I said, that has to be the title of the book. You know, it spells out this sort of close, close friendship between men in the war.
Plus, later in the program, we'll review some top tracks with Lewis Robinson, owner of the Mace Um Discos label. That's all ahead right here on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. Plenty to look forward to then in today's programme. Before we begin all of that, let's catch up on the latest news from all around the world.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Paul Osborne. Iraq's Prime Minister is calling for a state of emergency after Islamist militants took control of large parts of the city of Mosul. Hundreds of heavily armed men seized control of the provincial government offices, destroying police stations and overrunning the airport and army headquarters. Nouri al-Maliki says a swift response is needed. The Speaker of Iraq's Parliament, Osama al-Nujafi, says the US has been asked to help repel the attack.
We are facing a very serious crisis, a crisis that's represented by a foreign invasion of Iraq by terrorist groups from various different countries, occupying cities and killing innocent people and overthrowing the state in a blatant way. What has happened over the past few days and today is a total occupation of Nineveh province.
In the last half hour, the U.S. State Department has said it's offering all appropriate assistance to Iraq. Five U.S. soldiers have been killed in Afghanistan accidentally by their own side. Two Afghans also died in a NATO airstrike in Zabul province. Afghan officials say that coalition forces called in air support after a Taliban attack. NATO says it's investigating. There's been another militant attack on the airport in the Pakistani city of Karachi. Gunmen on motorbikes shot at security guards before fleeing the scene. The Pakistani Taliban says it was behind the attack and one on Sunday, in which at least 38 people died. In the United States, police are responding to reports of a shooting at a school in Oregon. Students have now been evacuated from Reynolds High School in Troutdale, which is near to Portland. Iranian officials have warned a deadline for agreeing a permanent deal on the country's nuclear program may have to be extended. Talks between Iran and world powers are meant to end in a formal agreement by the middle of July, but officials from Iran and the US have been meeting in Geneva today to try to resolve a series of disputes. A summit on the use of sexual violence in war zones has started in London. It follows a two-year campaign to try to get nations to sign up to a promise to halt the use of rape in conflict and punish attackers. The actress Angelina Jolie, who is a UN special envoy, is hosting the summit.
It is a myth that rape is an inevitable part of conflict. There is nothing inevitable about it. It is a weapon of war aimed at civilians. It has nothing to do with sex, everything to do with power. It is done to torture and humiliate innocent people, and often very young children.
Foreign ministers from Russia, Germany, and Poland have met, but there's been no apparent breakthrough on the crisis in Ukraine. Poland called on Russia to control its border and stop separatists and weapons reaching eastern Ukraine. Meanwhile, Ukraine's new president, Petro Poroshenko, has ordered the creation of humanitarian corridors to allow civilians to escape areas where the fighting is continuing. The German Chancellor Angela Merkel has again said that she wants Jean-Claude Juncker to be the next president of the European Commission. But in talks with the British Prime Minister David Cameron, he has again said that Mr. Juncker is not an acceptable candidate because of his support for closer European integration. A decision is due by the end of the month. Despite the disagreement, Mr. Cameron said the talks, which also involved the Prime Ministers of Sweden and the Netherlands, did make progress.
We've agreed that we should work together to address the abuse of free movement. It is right that people should be able to move across Europe to work, but they should not be able to free ride on the back of welfare systems. We're four leaders willing to confront the challenges facing the EU, to address the problems that stir disillusionment amongst Europe's citizens.
That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, Paul. More news from Paul Osborne at the bottom of the hour. Right now, though, it's just ticking towards 6 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
位于伦敦, 这是 Monocle 24.
Op London, du er Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London,
this is Londres.
Orlando,
London. London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House, live here on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards. Joining me now with their take on the news of the day, right here in Studio One, are both Daniela Pellet, an editor at the Institute for War and Peace Reporting, and James Schneider, editor-in-chief of Think Africa Press. So welcome both to the programme. Great to have you with us, as always. We'll begin today in Israel, where legislators have been busy choosing a new president. They've made their decision. They've elected Reuven Rivlin, a veteran Likud lawmaker, to the post. The former minister and speaker will succeed Shimon Peres next month. Daniel, if I can start with you. Rivlin is a member of Netanyahu's Likud party, obviously. Will they be at odds over any significant issues? What do we know about what this will likely tell us about the sort of nature of their political relationship?
Well, their political relationship, it can be summed up in one word. Bad. They have a terrible relationship. Netanyahu really doesn't like Rivlin. Would have loved to see him not be speaker, and didn't endorsed him very, very, very reluctantly. Reuven Ruby is his nickname, and he, as many Israeli politicians, he's sort of lovingly known by a little nickname. So Ruby Rivlin is a curious thing. He is super hardline. He's absolutely opposed to the two-state solution. And yet, as the speaker of the Knesset, he staunchly defended freedom of speech, just as the trajectory which Israeli legislation is going towards, sort of making the space for debate smaller. He stands up for the minority rights, for Israeli Arabs, defended it, the right of Israeli Arab Knesset members to speak and to dispute. And yet he is very pro-settler, very much one-state solution, which makes it, I think it's going to be an interesting 7-year presidency. I mean, Shimon Peres was the ultimate international diplomat, seen schmoozing and cheek kissing with
all
celebrities.
Well, I was going to ask you, obviously, he's a sort of a Nobel laureate. I mean, a hard act to follow, probably, in any case. Are you surprised then that they've gone down this particular avenue? Is it making a broader statement to the international community or to any of the actors in this is sort of long, ongoing peace?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, they had to choose from the circles that they had to choose from. The only non-political possibility was a Nobel Prize winner, but for chemistry, not peace. Although Peres signally failed to bring peace despite having won a Nobel Prize. I mean, Shimon Peres, like I said, ultimate, consummate Israeli president, almost as if the role was created for him. Now, a president's role in a normal country is also to be a figurehead to the nation, you know, a uniting figure as well as somebody to represent them internationally. As far as that goes, Ruby Rivlin isn't a terrible choice. You know, he's, as I said, he's very much into speaking up for equal rights, freedom of speech, although he has a troubling record of not being very keen on Reform Judaism, even though he's a secular Jew. As a figurehead for Israel, well, as somebody who personally thinks the government of Benjamin Netanyahu is a pretty bad one for Israel, and the peace process, I say it's a good thing because he's not going to be a fig leaf. You could have argued that Peres was. Ruby Rivlin, will genuinely represent what is really one of the most pro-settler governments that it's possible to imagine.
And just in terms of the wider role then of the president, because people say, well, look, it's largely ceremonial. It doesn't actually make that much difference. But, you know, he clearly is at odds with Netanyahu. Do you think he'll be trying to shift the focus of what the president does back to local issues? Is that going to be what his agenda is? Or do you think that he will have something to say, he will have his two cents, and that he could actually sort of rub up against Netanyahu on the big issues of the day in an uncomfortable way for both of them?
Well, definitely. I mean, it's going to be more uncomfortable for Netanyahu. I mean, Rivlin was very much opposed to government policy before. In the Sharon era, he was very much opposed to the disengagement, although as a true believer in democracy, and I don't think anyone can doubt that, he will go along with it. But the interesting thing to remember is that under the Israeli system, it's the president's role after a general election to decide who they need to call on to form a government. Well, casting my eyes into the future, it would be very interesting if Netanyahu came head-to-head with another figure. I mean, who would Rivlin choose under those circumstances?
James, obviously the sort of detail of this is intriguing. Just in very broad terms, I wonder, do you think that it's an error to really look at these appointments, especially when we look at something like Middle East peace, and try and pick over the details, the nuances? What could it mean, you know, as we look forward over the next couple of years? It probably doesn't mean very much, doesn't it? We should just engage with the fact that that's a frontier that perhaps doesn't hold much promise for any of the main actors.
Yeah, I don't think that peace with Israel-Palestine looks particularly likely in the next kind of couple of years, exactly as you say. But personalities do matter at these kind of top levels. And I mean, I don't know very much about the new Israeli president, but the fact that Shimon Peres would engage when the Pope came to Jerusalem and made his big statements and said he would go and have his prayer meeting with Abbas in the Vatican does show that the kind of inclinations or kind of relative openness of leaders does matter. So it could be important, but I'm not quite the expert Daniela is.
And Daniela, just on that international stage then, what will other sort of foreign dignitaries and visitors find when they meet Rivlin? Is he a man who's engaging to be around? Is he
totally.
Is he an awkward customer, or is he fairly straight talking?
He is super jovial, slightly chubby, friendly, very fond of cracking a joke. Really very, very popular, very seen as a very, very decent figure, despite his impeccable, almost extreme right-wing credentials. So as somebody to have a chitty chat with, you know, have a bit of a joke over a giant falafel, you know, whatever they do at these Israeli state meetings, is great. He's very, very likable, but his politics are not what the Israeli government want to project right now, because for all his personal feelings, whatever they may be, Netanyahu pays lip service to the two-state solution. Rubi Rivlin has never even tried to do that.
Definitely one, I think, to watch with interest. Well, let's move on now to Libya. Prime Minister Ahmed Maytek says he's stepping down to comply with a court ruling saying his election was unconstitutional. James, since the vote in May, Libya's had two prime ministers. Abdullah al-Thani has not ceded power either. What's happening there? Is this the deeply rooted mess that it appears to be looking in from the outside?
Yes, and although the fact that he has stood down, the current prime minister has stood down, and the prime minister that he replaced, who also stood down but then came back in because he didn't like the guy who had replaced him or the method through which he was replaced, is now the caretaker prime minister again. And the fact that that's happened in a reasonably orderly constitutional manner is positive, but it doesn't change the backdrop. And the backdrop is large-scale fighting in the east of the country, embedded militias all over the country, also embedded, you know, very strong militias within the state architecture. So one of the ways they tried to bring together all of the different militias after the fall of Gaddafi was to bring them in and say, right, well, you can basically keep all of your structures and the way in which you fought the war, but you'll be given a state salary. And so what is taking place now is some of those militias who are technically part of the government are fighting on the side of someone who is only kind of semi-part of the government, this sort of renegade general who's somehow got air power and is attacking Islamists with kind of tacit support from the US and other Western powers. So there's a kind of nice element to this story that he's stepped down after being told to by a court, which is positive. It's in a really bad backdrop.
Daniel, that's a pretty bleak portrait, and it does seem to be this very kind of toxic mix of politics, ideology, there's secular movements, there's religions, they're all at odds with one another. Is this an unsolvable mess, though? I mean, James mentioned there the sort of tacit support of other actors from without. Who should be attempting to do anything about this? Or is it one of these situations that you fear is going to simmer away rather awfully for a pretty long time to come?
Well, I think the danger of simmering is quite high. But I think the person and the element to watch in all this is, as you said, the renegade general, Khalifa Haftar, who seems to have come. I mean, he's been on one side, he's been on the other side, he's been in exile, he's back in Libya. The obvious parallel, I guess, is to Egypt and the strongman al-Sisi, because I think the danger is when you have a revolution followed by a period of instability, you get the general public really very sick and tired of having to live their lives in fear, and they will welcome, at the end of the day, somebody who brings stability. Now, Sisi won pretty because they didn't really have any other option but to elect him. But still, I mean, it's impossible to tell, but I don't know how unpopular he would have been even if he had had some competition, because I think people's desire quite naturally for a bit of peace and quiet and a bit of stability is very strong. So it's early days, but I think this is the element to watch, because he's so staunchly anti-Islamist. And as you said, you know, with perhaps the tacit support of the West.
Yeah, the US ambassador to Libya, she said, it's not something along the lines of, it's not necessarily my place to condemn actions against specific Islamist threats, which is basically as much as you can say, go on, lad, you know, go get him.
And James, what about this idea then of the strongman as a sort of galvanising force? You can imagine popular dissatisfaction with instability reaching the point that they actually gravitate maybe towards someone who's a lot more direct, if we can put it that way. But with all of these disparate elements, some of which you alluded to earlier, is it possible to actually galvanise that situation, or are the rifts and divides too profound, too deep?
It's significantly more difficult because, yeah, exactly as you say, the current kind of coalition of forces that he's got fighting in Benghazi and also a little bit in Tripoli against Islamist currents, Ansar al-Sharia and other associated groups, and how many Ansar al-Sharias are there, that's an open question as well, has, you know, there are regionalists, there are separatists, there are liberals, there are statists, there are all sorts of different forces that are allied with him at the moment. But also he doesn't have support of lots of other regional groups and regional militias that just aren't involved in this particular fight that's taking place between some Islamist groups and some non-Islamist or secular groups. So I don't think he quite has the same kind of institutional framework that he can just assert his authority as a strong man in the same way that Sisi could. Because for Sisi to assert his authority, he needed, you know, enormous state power within the police, the military, control of media, flying planes around, you know, blowing hearts at protesters. He had an enormous, you know, state apparatus of control, which Haftar doesn't have. And also they've got a problem of money, which is the oil, obviously, at the moment isn't flowing. They've got about an eighth coming out as what was happening pre-revolution. The central bank says they've lost $30 billion already this year, or maybe that was in the last 10 months. But in any event, a large amount of money. And so the ability to pay off all the various different militias, which is going to be necessary at some point, is really lacking for any central authority, either current or potential.
And when we have other further elections due later this month to replace sort of National Congress, you've had certain bodies acting as a parliament. What to make of those sorts of elections? Are they going to be shambolic? One doesn't want to damn it. Do they represent a prospect of any kind of change? Are we right to read too much even into them?
I think your impulses are right. We should not just write them off full stop, but we should be very clear about what the electoral process and the parliamentary or the constitutional assembly process has been, which has been marked by gunmen attacking, you know, parliament when it's sitting, gunmen coming in the middle, but, you know, of events like, you know, basically driving off members so that there's a rump parliament. So whilst all these processes that take place, they should be sort of relatively applauded, and they shouldn't be, oh, well, that's just a nothing process. But still, it does come down to who's got the guns, because the reason why the man who was made prime minister after the previous one stood down, and he stood down because his family got attacked by a different militia. The reason why he was able to become prime minister is he was voted through by half of the constituent assembly, because the other half had been chased off by another militia. So it really is this kind of very unpleasant and intricate layering of all these different militia groups that is more important than the election, although that doesn't mean the election is nothing.
James Schneider and Daniela Peled with me today on Midori House. We're going to take a very short break and we'll be back talking about Nigeria and Hillary Clinton, amongst other things, after this.
What designs will you be wearing next season? How will architecture change the face of your city? And which redesign will affect the paper you pick up?
It's very strange. It's like two triangles and two squares more. But I think that's a stimulus for the architect.
The kerning can take 5 times as long as actually designing the letter forms, which seems fairly brutal.
Is it going to perform? Is it going to stay the same? Is it going to be the same? That's normal anxiety.
Good design improves our lives. If you want to find out how, join me, Monocle's design editor Tom Morris, every Tuesday on Monocle 24.
If you're after a soundtrack to your working day, look no further than Monocle 24's Globally Minded playlist. We play the very best upbeat music from around the world, around the clock. Whether that's jazz from Japan, pop from Paris, house from Hamburg, or soul from Seoul. It's all picked by our team and presented by our editors. So get lost in music with Monocle 24's playlist right here, day and night, on Monocle 24.
You are listening to Monocle 24. This is Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. Still with me, I'm delighted to say, are both Daniela Peled and James Schneider. Let's turn next to Nigeria, where the militant group Boko Haram has kidnapped at least 20 women, not far from where hundreds of schoolgirls were abducted earlier this year in the north of the country. James, if I can start with you, it seems as if Goodluck Jonathan, the whole government infrastructure, hasn't really managed to get to grips either with the fundamental problems, the instability in this part of the country, or with how they should be presenting their case of what they're trying to do to the rest of the world. Again, is that unfair, or is this a government that has basically lost the ability to control the situation of what's happening here?
No, I think that's completely fair. And they've also, as you said, lost control of the narrative entirely. I mean, I think Goodluck Jonathan's first act should be to sack all of his spokesmen first, and then he should try to deal with the crisis in the northeast. I mean, there have been concerted sort of attempts to change policy at different points beforehand, which have had an impact. So the reason why, or in the last kind of 18 months since the state of emergencies were declared in the three northeastern states, and the joint task force was brought forward, it has changed what Boko Haram could do and has done. So whilst they've killed many more people, it's been localized to these three northeastern states. But they haven't really thought about it beyond that, or it doesn't appear to have thought about it beyond that. And I'm told that behind the scenes with the Nigeria's allies, military allies and security allies, there's a lot of ill feeling but about what the strategy could or should be, and who's stepping on whose toes and who's not doing enough, and a lot of kind of harsh words being said between US and Britain and Nigeria on a kind of quiet level. Because on the surface, you can't really see what the government is doing. Its PR is appalling, and it hasn't come out and said, right, what our strategy has to be now is X, Y, Z, this is how we're going to do it. We need this from our regional partners, Cameroon, you need to do this. And it's all been a bit of a, oh, please don't blame me, let's look the other way. It's pretty unseemly.
How have they got it so wrong, Daniela? Because it's not as if they haven't had warning. It's not as if the unravelling of their strategy hasn't been fairly apparent to all who've been looking on for a number of months. How do we explain such inaction, incompetence? Is it fear of doing the wrong thing? What would be behind their thinking or lack of it?
To be fair, in any country, this is an incredibly complex situation, counterinsurgency. So you're looking for a military solution, you're looking for a security solution. And to use that horrible old cliche, you're looking for hearts and minds and how to stop people being radicalised. So this is no simple task. But certainly it can't, no government can make any headway in this. When frankly, it's not really quite functioning. I mean, the military is enormous and well-equipped, but hugely corrupt, hugely inefficient, hugely mismanaged. Public confidence in the military, I have to say, must be incredibly, incredibly low. People don't trust the military, and they have no reason to. So added to the fact that it's an enormous country and the ethnic and religious tensions, it's a huge challenge. And you know, you're quite right, one that they have not been up to. I mean, was it last week or the week before they announced, we've found the girls, we know where they are. Oh, but we can't do anything about it because they might get hurt. I mean, as far as media strategies go, it's astonishingly inept.
It wasn't one. Let's move on to someone who perhaps has a slightly more canny understanding of how the media works. So the former Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, of course, likely presidential hopeful, I think it's safe to say. She's published her new memoir, Hard Choices. Amongst other topics in the book, she talks about her time as America's top diplomat, reveals a few insider details on various world leaders she's met. We should remember, of course, she visited 112 countries in her 4 years, which is impressive going. Is it safe to say this is Hillary sort of finally kicking off her campaign? Do you think this is the sign that she's going to actually sort of commit to making public what her ambitions are for the next couple of years?
Yeah, I reckon so. I mean, her campaign, just without her open support but with her tacit support, has been up and running for a really long time. She's got PAC, a super PAC, which has been trying to drum up support for quite a while. And now she's playing the kind of classic game, I'll let you know when I've had some more time to think about it. it's very clear. A lot of the press is focused on how it's a bit of a fight back or against Republican attacks of how she handled the killing of the American ambassador in Benghazi in Libya. So that's probably quite strong. I mean, I haven't read it, but from the quotes that I've seen pulled out in the press, everyone's making a very big deal about these pen portraits of world leaders. And everything she's appears that she's said in this book, pretty sure I've heard her say beforehand, like the crush on David Miliband, how she's actually quite pally with Benjamin Netanyahu. I mean, I thought these things were already known.
These truths were out. What about the very act then of writing the book, Daniela? Is this a new sort of era in US politics that the American public wants to see its prospective leaders having committed their thoughts to paper? Obama did it. Almost all these frontline politicians seem to either be writing a book, having just written one, or planning to write one. Do people want to see that? Is it demand, do you think? Or do you think she basically just had some things she wanted to get off her chest?
Well, I think she's going to be faced with two main issues in her campaign, in her rather inevitable campaign. And one of them is her record as Secretary of State, because Obama's foreign policy era has not been covered in glory. So I think this is her opportunity, as James said, to try and finesse her stance and say, I wanted to do something different on Syria. We got it wrong, but it's not really my fault. And I think the other challenge she faces is, and it's the same challenge that all pretty much all American presidents face, is the charge that she's insulated from reality, that she's out of touch with the common people, particularly since she's been in public life for two decades. So that has something to it. So I think this also is a bit gossipy. She has a lovely turn of phrase. She talks about Ahmadinejad as a bellicose peacock. That's rather delightful. So this is, I don't know if she can come across as likeable, but the gossipy tone, I think, is going some way towards preparing her image.
One of the things I've seen picked up is her saying, when we left the White House, we were broke, which I don't think helps her seeming in touch with ordinary people, because I can't remember exactly what he earns, the president of the United States, but it's a damn sight more than the average.
But think of the legal fees, especially with Clinton.
Yes, there were a lot of, but then she says, it was very expensive. We had to pay for mortgages, plural, houses, plural,
right,
and Chelsea's education, which doesn't quite make her seem the, she gave a speech last week talking about, rising income inequality and how that was a bad thing. It doesn't really make her naturally sit with ordinary people.
Some of those first world problems that I've been reading about, evidently. Just before we go, and because, Daniel, you mentioned this giant falafel earlier, I thought we should return to what our politicians actually have to eat and how unhealthy they are. In South Africa, MPs are complaining that the meals in their parliamentary restaurant are making them fat. Of course, it's the meals that are being served, not the amount that they're electing to eat, of course. I just wondered about the general physical state and the culinary state of our leaders, given you mentioned that the falafel delicacy earlier. Any particular politicians anywhere in the world who should be watching what they're eating, do you think, in your personal experience?
Well, I have dined at the odd occasion in the House of Commons and in Portcullis House, and I have to say the food is yummy, delicious and subsidised. So maybe that's one of the reasons why all British politicians have their five a day.
And they're not too corpulent.
Well, some of them are, naming no names.
And James, what about you? On your travels, do you ever detect a particular problem with fine dining, maybe too much of it in any quarters?
I was in Libreville, in Gabon, a couple of weeks ago, and they were talking a lot, the government were talking a lot about how they wanted local production and local manufacturing and making stuff locally. And then I walked around and I found some British people making some sandwiches. I thought, what are you doing here? They'd imported the caterers from London, from I can't quite remember where, I'm not going to say where I think they got them from, but they brought them in from London and set them up there. So it's big business for some people.
And maybe some parliamentary double standards the whole world over as well. James Schneider and Daniela Pelleda, thank you both very much indeed for a delicious roundup of the day's big stories here on Midori House.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Лондрис, Нова Йорк, Токио.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
There is plenty still to come. In the second half of today's Midori House, we'll be in Buenos Aires. We'll be delving into the private and often intimate lives of soldiers during World War II. And we'll talk music with Lewis Robinson. That's all ahead, but first, let's get some world news headlines from Paul Osborne.
The United States says it will offer all appropriate assistance to Iraq after Islamist militants took control of large parts of the city of Mosul. Hundreds of heavily armed men seized control of the provincial government offices, police stations, the airport and army headquarters. The Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki says a swift response is needed. Five American soldiers and two Afghans have been killed in Afghanistan, apparently by their own side. The NATO airstrike was called in Zabul province in the south of the country after a Taliban attack. There's been another militant attack on the airport in the Pakistani city of Karachi. Gunmen on motorbikes shot at security guards, then fled the scene. The Pakistani Taliban says it was behind the attack and one on Sunday, in which almost 40 people were killed. And officials in Iran have warned that a deadline for agreeing a permanent deal on the country's nuclear program may have to be extended. Talks with world powers are meant to end in a formal agreement by the middle of July. But officials from Iran and the US have been meeting today in Geneva to try to resolve a series of disputes. And those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, Paul. More news from Paul Osborne, of course, at the top of the hour. That'll be 1900 here in London. You're listening to Midori House, live here on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards. It's time now to check in with one of our contributors around the world. Today we're heading to Buenos Aires to speak with Monocle's Irene Caselli, who is there. Irene, thank you very much indeed for joining us. Let's start with, courtroom shenanigans of one sort or another. Who's found themselves in the dock and what are we learning about them and their business with this case?
Well, the character is Amado Boudou, who's the vice president. At some point, Boudou was economy minister and then ran as vice president together with Cristina Fernandez, the president, in the 2011 elections. So what happened on Monday is that a judge forced the vice president to appear in a Buenos Aires court to answer questions. Now, this is still the initial phase. There are still no criminal charges that have been filed filed against him. But the accusation is that the vice president used his influence when he was an economy minister to take ownership of a company that printed the nation's currency. He's accused of using a frontman to buy shares in the printing company, which was then awarded a government contract and then nationalized. Now, this is obviously very serious because it's the first time that a vice president answers a criminal allegation since Argentina restored democracy in 83. And it's also the first time that a member of the current government is being questioned in connection to a corruption case. So far, no criminal charges have been filed. The judge is expected to announce his decision later this month. So we'll surely hear about this more. But this case has definitely attracted a lot of attention, not only because of questionings of the independence of the judicial system, but also because with the elections coming up next year, the opposition is also using this as a political instrument to attack the current government.
So intrigue in the courts. We'll have to follow that case very closely. Intrigue of a rather different sort, of a sporting character, of course. We're talking all this week a great deal here on Monaco 24 about the World Cup in Argentina's northern neighbour, Brazil, of course. Just days to go. What's the mood gripping Buenos Aires and another country that's just so passionate about its football, of course?
Yes, everyone is talking about football. Football is everywhere, on television, on the front pages of newspapers. It's impossible to miss it. Argentina's team flew out to Brazil on Monday, and hundreds of fans went to see them off. And this was broadcast live on a national television. And meanwhile, there was a whole different scandal that was taking place in Brazil already, where many Argentinian journalists were stationed in Cidade do Galo, which is where the sports compound is that will be hosting the Argentinian national team. That's in Belo Horizonte, just north of Rio de Janeiro. There was initially a sign at the sports compound at the gate, which said, "Welcome future champions." Now, when journalists, Argentinian journalists, printed this back home, there was a bit of a back and forth that happened, and eventually it was found out that it was a member of the Argentinian Football Association that had put that sign up. But we need to remember that not only the big star of Argentina, obviously Leo Messi, is very humble, but also the coach. And so the sign within hours was taken off, and now there's just a simple welcome sign. The papers have also been busying themselves publishing all the material, the food that the team has taken to Brazil. And one of the funny details is that among several things, there are kilos of dulce de leche, which is the milk-based caramel that is very typical here in Argentina, as well as mate, which is the tea-like hot beverage that Argentinians drink all the time. Now, we've also heard, however, that the first that there's been an Argentinian deported from Brazil. Now, he was allegedly a barra brava or hooligan from Rosario, which is Messi's hometown. And allegedly, he was part of a blacklist that the Argentinian government had sent to Brazilian authorities to avoid clashes. His lawyer is saying that he's just a fan and not a hooligan, but everyone is watching this very closely.
Well, let's hope that any of those barra bravas are kept well away from the action, of course. Irene, just tell me something a little different, another change of pace. So the rivers in northern Argentina, the Paraná and the Iguazu rivers, this is having a bit of an impact. They're changing, the character is changing, and it's having an impact on some of the national parks. Tell us what's been going on.
Yes, so Iguazu Falls, which is one of the symbols of tourism in South America and also worldwide, it's considered one of the many wonders of the world and it is one of the largest falls in the world. So the park that hosts Iguazu Falls in Argentina was shut down because of rainfall. And Argentina authorities are saying that the Iguazu River that feeds the falls is carrying 33 times more water than normal. We've seen some images which are very dramatic. There is a wooden walkway above the falls from which you get usually a stunning view. And now all of that is completely covered in water. Now the rainfall has been very high over the past week, and it has also affected southern Brazil, where 9 people became victims and died during the weekend. But this goes back to the World Cup once more. One of the main worries, not only in Brazil but also here in Argentina, is that the rainfall may affect Curitiba, which is one of the World Cup host cities, where Iran will be playing Nigeria next week. Iran and Nigeria are in the same group as Argentina. Now, the stadium is still undergoing renovation works and has not been finished up yet. So, you know, in the end, everything goes back to the World Cup. Even that coverage, the coverage of, you know, what is potentially, a natural disaster, goes back to football over here this time.
Irene Caselli in Buenos Aires, thank you as always for joining us here on the programme. Up next on Midori House, we'll look at the intimate lives of World War II soldiers. Stay tuned.
The Monocle app puts Monocle 24's pacey mix of current affairs, business, culture and music in your pocket. Whether it's midnight in Marunouchi or sunrise in Sydney, tune in to our around-the-clock audio service live from Midori House. Or download and replay your favourite programmes using the Time Shift feature. Also at your fingertips, our complete global travel guide. Get all this and more on the go on the Monocle app.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. The experiences of service veterans in the Second World War have been exhaustively chronicled in countless films, books and TV programmes. Faced with the volume of documentaries, eyewitness accounts, novels, poetry, satire and more, one might think there was pretty much nothing left to say on the subject. Leave it to the German publisher Taschen, though, to find a rich and underexplored aspect of the wartime experience. On the 1st of July, the venerable art book imprint will release a 320-page hardback called My Buddy, World War II Laid Bare, compiled by Taschen's sexy books editor, Diane Hansen. Including hundreds of privately held, candid photographs taken around the world, the book captures the bravado, playfulness and vulnerability of young men in the prime of their lives. Mike Dodge Weisskopf caught up with World War II veteran Scotty Bowers and the book's editor, Diane Hansen, at Taschen's HQ in Los Angeles.
The 91-year-old World War II veteran Scotty Bowers is describing how he met Diane Hansen, sexy books editor for the German publisher Taschen.
I met Diane hitchhiking on Sunset Boulevard.
Yeah, and you know, I asked him for $25, and he said, I'm the one who always gets $25, and then we figured it just canceled it out, and we went to a motel.
So we broke even, you know.
So it's not the real story, but it's emblematic of the playfully saucy relationship between these two pioneers, one who fought on the battlefields of Guadalcanal and Iwo Jima, and the other who brought the worlds of lowbrow and highbrow together with a gorgeously subversive series of art books. Their worlds have finally converged in print with Taschen's publication of My Buddy, World War II Laid Bare, a hardback volume containing over 500 images of soldiers at work and at play in various states of undress. Diane says that her introduction to the collection was entirely incidental.
The photographer Michael Stokes got in touch with me, and he had pitched a book of his photographs before, and he photographs a lot of contemporary military guys. But he had said he loves to see a man in uniform, but even better is when you see the real guys, and he had this big collection. Just as an aside, I have this big collection of World War II photographs of nude males, and I just instantly, it's like, oh, can I come over? Let me come over and look at that. That's a lot more interesting to me. And he brought out album after album, these little albums with these little tiny photos, and I just knew.
My Buddy is broadly divided into 6 thematic sections, each representing a certain aspect of military life. The earlier sections include everyday activities like bathing and building dams, But as the book progresses, a more mischievous side emerges.
You know, it's like foreplay. You start with the guys who are just bathing, they're working in the water, they're getting their VD checks, they're sitting on the toilet, and then you get to the end and you get the exhibitionists.
Section 6, titled Grab Ass, is the section most likely to attract viewers of Hansen's previous sexy books, those who just want to see a bunch of late adolescent guys letting it all hang out. Scotty Bowers explains the tradition of grab ass and what it meant for young men like him in the service.
In the Marine Corps, that's what they call playing grab ass. You know, you guys are fooling around in the nude, you know, you're swimming and you're doing this and that, and you're just playing grab ass. These guys are all kind of square and straight, and a guy might do a little, if somebody's taking his picture, he might do something he wouldn't normally do just for the sake of the picture, you know what I mean? Give his buddy a kiss, grab his cock, do something, which has nothing to do with anything except just playing grab ass, you know? They're young guys that are square, and the only thing they've got thinking about is their girlfriend back home, who they probably haven't even laid yet, but they eventually hope to, you know? But the bit is, these guys are all square and straight, and they're just fooling around, you know what I mean?
But the titillating horseplay of grab ass is only the bait that Hansen hopes will lure readers into my buddy's deeper investigation of the culture of manhood in the military and the ways in which men learn to care for one another under the most horrific of circumstances.
We actually named the book after a song, as you see in there, from 1922. And when I found that there was a song called My Buddy, right away I knew all and read the lyrics. And I thought, my God, these lyrics are so loving. And I said, that has to be the title of the book. You know, it spells out this sort of close, close friendship between men in the war. And then to find out it was actually written as a love song.
Yeah.
I miss your voice, the touch of your hand, just to know that you understand. My buddy, your buddy misses you. And it was completely accepted in World War II that this was about war buddies. When I discussed, particularly with the owner of the archive, Michael Stokes, about how the photos would be presented, he was very concerned, and we were too, that we not show any disrespect to the people in the photographs. And we wanted to present the pictures in context, and so we had to show the greater context of war. What you see among most of these pictures, they were all non-combat photographs, and it makes war look like a pretty happy, carefree time. So I went and I searched other sources to find photographs of men in less happy circumstances, but where they are bonding, to show the close bonds that developed during war. When I found the pictures of the men comforting each other, holding each other, and believe me, there were a lot more like that, I knew that they would make this a more serious work and put it into the realm of history.
Hansen didn't just limit herself to photographs when assembling the full tableau of military life as portrayed in My Buddy. The book also contains reproductions of vintage advertisements, magazine covers, and other illustrations from period publications, which portray a highly stylized and idealized version of military life. And this, not to put too fine a point on it, is where the sensibility of My Buddy tips over into the homoerotic.
The fact of it is, I mean, this is the cover. This one here, where we see naked men frolicking in the river and washing their clothes, is the cover of Leatherneck, the Marine Corps' own personal magazine. This is my favorite ad. Now, I knew about the cannon towels, and I went off right away to get the cannon towels. But look at the perspective on this. You see this giant hand. The hand is way in the foreground with the glowing ice cream. Are these guys looking at the ice cream cone? No, they are not. Their gaze is straight across at each other. So I don't know who this artist is, but I believe that this artist knew what he was doing, because he clearly knew how to paint. He knew how to draw. He would have known how to make their eyes go towards the ice cream cone.
That was gay. And this was his feeling.
He chose not to, yes. He made his artistic expression. There's nothing I like more than old magazines and bright print ads, everything about old magazines. So this gave me an opportunity to go. I already knew there was a lot of this material out there. It was not the majority of what you found during World War II, but probably an eighth of what was out there would have these kind of themes. And a lot of it was when the U.S. devised their propaganda stance for World War II, It was not about hating the enemy. It was not about whipping up hatred, which they did in Europe. It was showing them everything that was wonderful at home, everything that they were fighting for, everything they were missing. And so a lot of this was family and affection too. And they didn't, when they put ads in magazines that were for the people at home, they didn't want to show them people with their arms blown off out on a battlefield. They wanted it to look like if they sent towels to their boys in the military, those guys were going to have a good time. That was all it was going to take them out of the wretchedness of war and give them this respite and pleasure. So, cannon towel tales. What else are they going to do with a towel?
Diane Hansen is Taschen's sexy book editor and the editor and compiler of My Buddy, World War II Laid Bare, published by Taschen in July 2014. World War II veteran Scotty Bowers wrote the book's introduction.
And that was Mike with Scotty Bowers and editor Diane Hansen coming to us from Los Angeles. You are listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards. It's time now for our daily review, where we sort through the best and sometimes the worst in the worlds of television, cinema, theatre, books and more. Today we're talking music, and joining me now, I'm happy to say, is Lewis Robinson, owner of the label Meus Discos. Lewis, welcome to Midori House. Good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me. Good afternoon.
So tell me, everyone here at Midori House is talking about Brazil, but we're talking about the World Cup. But I gather your attentions are not so much on the football. You're all about the music.
Yes. I've had, I started a label called Mizum Discos 4 years ago to kind of try and show the alternative sounds to Brazil. I found that a lot of people thought Brazil began and ended with bossa nova or samba. But obviously, Brazil is a huge country with many, many different styles. So I was trying to reflect the kind of other sides of Brazilian music that weren't really being promoted in Europe.
How did you find, what was the reaction like then when you've been sort of going through that work then? Are people sort of, I don't know, almost disappointed if they don't get the sort of bossa stylings that they're expecting? Or are they actually really, really switched on when you sort of reveal to them or the complexities that exist there?
Yeah, people have been really encouraging. We released our first compilation and people were kind of, it got like a lot of good reviews and people were kind of, I guess, a little surprised at how much was going on in Brazil. I mean, I think people forget how big it is, you know, to travel from the north to the south takes about 7 hours on a plane. So it's like crossing Europe. So as you can imagine, there's just as many different styles and genres within the country.
I think we should play some little extracts just to get a bit of a flavour. What should we kick off with? We've got Juliana, maybe that's the first one. Tell us a little bit about this.
Yeah, so this is Juliana Padijal with a song called Que Bon, which means that's good. And it's kind of, it's just the sort of a little upbeat song. She's done it in the style of a frevo, which is from the northeast of the country. She's from a town called Belo Horizonte, which is more in the centre. And it's, again, it's, I guess she's kind of an indie musician, if we were to use sort of Western terms, as it were. But the as you'll find with a lot of musicians from Brazil, they kind of mix up sort of Western influences like rock or whatever with their local styles or other styles from Brazil. So she's kind of done a sort of kind of, I don't know, an indie frevo. And it's just a great kind of dance tune.
Well, let's take a listen then. This is K-Bomb. Let's take a listen to it now.
Ser contemporâneo seu, assim você não precisa atravessar paredes, nem eu. O ser é ilimitado.
Well, I was just getting into that, and it's finished already. Juliana Pedigal with K-Bomb. Is the music then, you talked about that sort of trying to engage with people who have these cliched views of what Brazilian music is like. Is it all upbeat? Is there a sorrowful element as well, don't you find?
Yeah, I mean, they have. But there's this thing from Brazil called saudade, which is this kind of a longing for something that's long gone, which is very apparent in music like bossa nova. I mean, obviously a lot of people think, yeah, Brazil, carnival, blah, 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 World Cup. But, you know, I mean, Brazil is a very complex country now, and there's many different sides to it. So, and especially with the geography, which I always come back to, you know, people from the south of the country is much more of a European influence. So they're much kind of paler and, I guess, more European looking. When you go to the far north, to Belém or Macapá or in the Amazon, you know, they just look completely different. It's a completely different race almost. So I think that's the thing with Brazil. There's so many different kind of people there and so many different mixes. And yeah, it's a fascinating country.
It is. And that mix is pretty intoxicating. Let's hear some more music. Shall we hear from Trupo Chá de Boldo next? Tell us a bit more about this one first.
Yeah, so this is Trupo Chá de Boldo. I was told that this means, chá means tea, and apparently Chá de Boldo is tea for a hangover. And the song's called Na Garrafa, which means from the bottle. So, I mean, I don't think they're all about drinking. I think they do other things as well. But this is great. It's just the kind of quirky, they're from Sao Paulo. Sao Paulo is a very cosmopolitan city, you know, just as cosmopolitan as, say, London is. And they're kind of like a little collective who are mixing up different styles. And this one's got a bit of a kind of, I don't know, disco, funk, punky vibe to it.
That sounds good. Let's take a listen.
Não quero gota, não quero gota. Quero você gostoso todo na garrafa. Não quero gota.
Garrafa, that's a Trupo Chá de Boldo. It's interesting, that band sort of formed or came together in sort of 2005. It didn't put their album, first album down until 5 years later. I guess they were just touring and playing. It's this little collective, as you said. Is there a very different sort of performance culture? Is it more about playing and experiencing music instead of necessarily kind of, you know, just cranking out records and trying to get your music out there?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's going this way the whole world over, which is, I think, is a good thing, like, back to the live show, because this is the way that music should be experienced. But in Brazil, again, because of the size of the country, I mean, as a band, you can just tour Brazil now. You start in the north and you end up in the south and you go back again. You can just do that the whole year round just because it's so large. So it's about live shows for bands. And obviously with the decline in the music industry across the world, you know, there are record shops in Brazil, but they're not as many as there used to be. The recording industry there is tiny compared to what it used to be. So, you know, in order to get your kind of music out there, they do make albums, but what a lot of them tend to do, or most of them, in fact, is give the albums away for free from their websites. So if you're a fan of the band, you'll download the album and then hopefully you'll be able to go and see them live in your city or somewhere else.
Lewis, the clock is against us, but we've got one more track we want to play. Tell us a little bit about Zulumbi. This is a record that came out in February of this year.
Yeah, this is Zulumbi featuring Elo da Corrente. They're a hip-hop band from Sao Paulo, formed by a guy, Rodrigo Brandão. He's a very kind of influential hip-hop producer from the state. And yeah, it's just kind of a good time party hip-hop tune.
Lewis Robinson from Mesh Discos, thanks very much for coming to see us today. And we'll play you out with this one then from Zulumbi. This is Sabacinho do Insano.
Sempre frente, sempre ter pé no chão e amor aos panos. Prazer pelos delírios do cotidiano. Todo dia é dia, toda hora é hora. Não espera acontecer, quem sabe faz agora. É tanta parada pra provar planeta fora. Tomar suco de amora, ouvir o som da flora. Porra, uma tora, vendo a aurora no apogeu. E num exemplo específico pra espécies como eu. Achar um vinil visado que mal foi usado. Num pico destacado e soltado um trocado.
That was Zulumbi with Sabacinho do Insano. My thanks to Lewis Robinson from Mesh Discos for telling us all about it. That's all we have time for today's edition of the programme. Thanks to our producer Daniel Giacopelli, our researcher Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Carlotta Ribello, and our studio manager Chris Chilvers. We're back at the same time tomorrow. Goodbye.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster Perpetual Watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world-famous, Oyster Perpetual Watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.